Welcome to Pop Culture Man Children. Black Lives Matter to all essential employees. Thank you for all that you do. I'm Mike Buongiorno, and I'm here today with the charming Nadia Cater.
Thank you, Mike. I'm so happy to be here.
Nadia, how is your quarantine going?
I'm watching more television than I've ever watched in my life.
And you watch a lot of television.
I do. It's so I'm a person that is designed to be at home. I love being at home. This is actually, you know, I'm not saying I'm glad COVID happened, but wow, I've had more time at home than I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
So it's just been like, wow, I haven't ridden the subway in 4 months.
Right.
It's unreal. It's unreal.
Yeah. If it were like 10 years ago when I were in my 20s, I bet I'd be really restless. But now I'm fine.
Yeah, you got all your stuff there.
Yeah, I'm fine. Who needs to go outside?
You have coffee. You got your toys. You got Disney Plus. What else do you need, Mike?
I know. I got a new recliner that vibrates.
Whoa.
Come on now. I got it made in the shade. So today's special episode, you and me are going to discuss the documentary Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street from this year, 2020. It was released, I don't know if it was released in theaters anywhere, but we watched it on Shudder, the horror streaming service. And actually it's called Scream, Queen. So it's telling you to scream, Queen.
Scream, Queen.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit of what is this movie about?
So, Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street, is about the first male Scream Queen and his experience with the second in the series of My Nightmare on Elm Street, Nightmare on Elm Street 2. Freddy's Revenge, which is a very controversial release because it was a very different Nightmare on Elm Street.
Right. So if you don't know, if you're not familiar with the Nightmare on Elm Street series, there's 6 original ones, and then there's Wes Craven's New Nightmare, and then there was the reboot, and there was Freddy vs. Jason. But you had part one, which was 1984, directed by Wes Craven. This is where Freddy Krueger comes from, and it sets up the rule of the world of Freddy Krueger, where Freddy will visit you in your dreams and kill you in your dreams. And only 1 year later, 1985, is A Nightmare on Elm Street 2. Wes Craven has nothing to do with this movie. And it really breaks the rules of the first movie because it's not about Freddy coming to you in your dreams. It's about Freddy is kind of possesses this boy who is the protagonist. Whereas typically in slasher movies, the protagonist is a female. The first A Nightmare on Elm Street has Heather Langenkamp as Nancy. And Freddy is trying to use this kid. He's trying to take over this kid to relive again and come out into the world. It's really the most different of Nightmare on Elm Street movies. And for a lot of diehard fans of the series, it's the most disliked. I could tell you when I was young and couldn't understand subtext, which is what we're going to talk about in a second, I just thought this is boring. This is the Nightmare on Elm Street that I really don't like. I like 3 because it's the Dream Warriors and it brings back Heather Langenkamp, and 3 is awesome and 2 is just like skip 2. But what people started to notice right away, really, in 85 was a strong homoerotic subtext in the film. And Mark Patton is the name of the actor who stars in A Nightmare on Elm Street 2. The documentary is really his story. And he's a really interesting guy.
Yeah. Mark Patton is also, well, I gotta say, throughout the documentary, he's very self-reflective, too.
Yeah.
And just, like, his experience making this movie, the aftermath, what was going on in his life, and how his life was so strongly affected, because this movie ruined his career.
Yeah, he was going along really well. Like, he tells the story of when he comes to New York from, I forget where he's from, but he's from a very conservative background where he had to get out. He even says, if I had stayed where I was born, I would have been killed. Some jock would have just killed me one day.
So you get the idea of like a rural kind of community.
Right.
He even says what helped him leave was his drama teacher, who was probably very obviously reading his queerness, was like, you have to leave and you have to go to New York. And I can't, can you imagine though, Mike, being 18 years old or 17 and someone telling you, you don't belong here and you have to leave to live? That blows my mind.
Yeah. But he also says when he gets to New York, he stays at a hotel, which is, he said it's a hotel mostly for sex workers at the time. But he said he paid $13.50 a week. Can you imagine that now? I think you pay that a second to live in New York.
Yeah.
To live in Manhattan. And that's only the 80s. But yeah, he's very good looking guy. He comes to New York and he says like it really wasn't hard. He like goes to an agent. The agent's like, all right, you're good looking, whatever. We'll put you in commercials. He starts making commercials. He goes and does a Broadway show, Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, which is directed by Robert Altman and stars Cher. And he's like, in the documentary, he starts talking about Cher. And I was like, is he just talking about Cher because he's a gay man? And Cher is so big in their community. But it's like, no, he actually knows Cher. He actually worked with and is friends with Cher. And
that blew my mind.
Yeah, and then Robert Altman makes a movie of that play, which he's in. And then they're like, okay, next you're going to be in this sequel to this popular movie. And he hadn't even seen A Nightmare on Elm Street. And he went and saw it, and he was like, oh, okay, well, this is not my type of thing. And then he did it, and it comes out, and the fans hate it. And people see the subtext, but what you have to understand, what's, I think, fascinating about this story is it's about how a text can be read differently in different contexts and by different groups of people. Now, and the documentary gets into this, there is a fandom and a community of queer horror fans who love this film and celebrate this film and have made this film into a cult classic and made him into a star. But at the time, you had a lot of homophobia and you had a lot of AIDS phobia. It's 85. You know, they make a big deal out of Rock Hudson dies around that time, and the tabloids go crazy for outing gay actors in Hollywood. And people who did see the homoerotic subtext in the film started basically hating him and sending him death threats and calling him the F word and like really treating him like shit. And his agents see him in the movie and they're like, listen, you can't play straight. You just can't. And then you start this feud between him and the writer of the film. And the writer of the film is a guy named David Chaskin. When people in the 80s and 90s would ask David Chaskin, oh, did you write the movie to have a homoerotic subtext? He at that time would say, no, not at all. If the movie comes off as being like queer, it's all because of Mark Patton. Mark Patton acts like a girl. He screams like a girl. That's all him, which in one way is outing him. And it's also blaming him for the failure of the movie because he's gay.
Oh yeah, that was so shocking to read about. Hear about when you're watching this documentary. Especially since we live in this time now where I don't know. I feel like we're in this point where we're not really blaming people for being gay as like a mainstream kind of thing, right?
Right. Like the writer for years was basically like, the movie's bad because of you. If you hadn't been in the movie, no one would call it a gay movie and it would have been a success and you ruined it.
Yeah. And then after it was, you know, the reading changed and people were really celebrating it for being a gay movie. That's when he kind of changed his tune and was like taking credit for the subtext.
Right. That's the thing that pisses me off about the writer of the film, because he's such a liar. Originally, he denies that there's gay subtext, which is crazy because there's a S&M club in the movie. Freddie ties up the gym coach and like whips him in the ass and you see male nudity. Like it's clearly got homoerotic stuff in it. But he would say, no, it's not a gay movie. And so does the director. The director also kind of plays ignorant.
That's what's blew my mind, is they have this scene in the documentary where he has a reunion with the cast for the first time they've seen each other in decades. And the director is like, yeah, I didn't know it was a gay movie. Patton is like, you filmed a gay bar. That was a gay male bar. And the director was like, oh, I didn't know it was a gay bar.
Right. And one of the other actors, not even Mark Patton, actually challenges him and is like, don't play naive. Like, this was a famous gay bar. Like, how can you say as a director you had no idea?
Yeah, that's true. He does.
But at least the director keeps his story straight. He says, like, he didn't know at all. Whereas the writer went from, it's not gay, to, okay, in the 2000s, he was like, okay, it does have gay subtext, but still Mark Patton made it overly gay and he ruined it. And now he's like, oh, I wanted it to be that way. This is like, he has changed his story. And Mark Patton is, you know, it kind of, the film ends with him confronting the writer and asking for an apology. And he's like, you know, you blamed me and you kind of outed me and said I was the reason why it was a problem. And he even says, well, I didn't write in the screenplay that you scream like a woman. You just screamed like a woman. Which is so infuriatingly offensive.
And also, like, what does that mean, scream like a woman? He, like, screamed in fear. When did we... like,
How do you not look vulnerable when screaming?
Exactly, right? It's like, how many horror movies have you and I watched where you see men, like, screaming in horror? It's, like, what does that mean, scream like a woman?
I mean, he is taking up, you know, there's a great book, by Carol J. Clover, who's a film theorist, called Men, Women, and Chainsaws. And if you don't know this book, you know the term final girl because she's the person who coined it. And the final girl is almost always a girl. The book gets into, you know, all of this. The book is really working off of Laura Mulvey and the whole male gaze theory. And it's all about identification and... She basically is like, why do young men who watch these movies still like them even though it's a female protagonist? And she gets into the psychosexuality, like the killers often are stunted in their maturity and the female becomes who the male identifies with because often in the end the female will pick up the weapon, the phallus, and become symbolically male. So there's a lot, it's interesting, you know, the theory, I don't know, totally holds up now, but it's an interesting book. But anyway, I think just putting any male, look, I will say that he is effeminate. I don't know if he's an actor, he could play anything, but like, I mean, what do you think?
Mark Patton is a little effeminate, I would say. I don't think that means that he made the movie gay at all. Because, Parsons is gay. He plays Sheldon. Right. Like, we see gay actors. Rock Hudson kissed so many women. He was really gay. What does that mean? Oh, sorry, what were you saying?
Well, I think putting a male in that role is in some... Like, it will call you to think about the male's gender anyway.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? Because it's traditionally a female role.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe men don't want to identify with a vulnerable male. Because when we see, like, a woman taking on, like, sort of masculine traits, it depends. But if you see a woman sort of taking charge, that could be played off in, a powerful way. Or it could be played off in, like, a bitch, right? But, like, with a man being effeminate, that's never, ever seen as a positive thing.
Right, right.
There's no positive spin there. So seeing a vulnerable man kind of puts people in an uncomfortable position.
Right.
So I think that's what was going on.
And I think people, you know, people seem to blame the movie's failure on Mark Patton or on the film being a gay film, quote-unquote. But I think that's just That's taking a film that doesn't really work and then taking an obvious target in the film and blaming that target. Because if the film doesn't work, it doesn't work because it's just not a good film, because it's boring, it doesn't follow the rules of the first movie, Freddy doesn't really act like Freddy acted, it's not that scary, like, the characters aren't that interesting. It's just not a good movie. I don't think the gayness of it is what made it bad. And I think actually the gayness of it is what makes it good now. That's why people like it now.
People, it would be completely forgettable if it didn't have the gayness in it.
No, it would be, yeah.
Because, like, have you watched A Nightmare on Elm Street 2 relatively recently?
No, I tried to, but it's not on, I couldn't find it.
Well, it might have changed, but I watched it maybe a year or two ago on Shudder. I love Shudder. And you're right. The writing isn't great.
Yeah.
And it could have been a really interesting movie if the writing was better, and maybe if it wasn't Freddy Krueger, because like you said before, it's taking the Freddy concept and just throwing it out the window.
Right. The whole dream thing is what was the interesting twist, and they get rid of the dream thing.
Yeah, and then it's like, what do you have? You have, like, a monster trying to take over a boy's body.
Yeah.
Which is, that could be spun into interesting ways that isn't homophobic, but that's not what was going on. Actually, the director tried to make that argument at one point, where, well, no, it's actually a homophobic movie.
Right. Well, there's a moment at the end when Mark Patton confronts the writer. He says, let me read you a quote that you gave. And the writer said, this isn't a homoerotic movie. It's a homophobic movie. This is the kind of movie that should be showed at conversion camps. It'll show you that the love of a woman will fix a gay man, which is wild. And then the writer's like, well, I said that as a joke. I didn't mean that.
Holds up now.
I actually think that horrible statement is the truth. Because there's a point where Mark Patton says to him, okay, you admit that it has a homoerotic subtext. Well, why would you write that? It's the 80s. And he doesn't come out and say it, but the implication is you're a straight writer. The writer's straight. So Mark Patton doesn't put a point on that, but it's kind of implied in the question, why would you write a film with a gay subtext as a straight writer? And he gives his bullshit about AIDS and the fear of coming out, and it's such lies. I actually think that what he said about homophobia is the truth. Mm-hmm. I think it is a homophobic movie. I think that was his intention. I think the audience has taken it and reclaimed it and recontextualized it and reformatted it and made it into a sort of positive celebration. But I actually do think if you're looking at the writer's intention, I think the gay subtext is there, and I think it's meant to be scary. I think it's meant to be like, oh my God, this is a scary thing.
Like, the worst thing that can happen to you is that you have gay thoughts.
Right. I really think that's what the writer, and by the way, he's done nothing else, this writer. This was basically it for him.
You know, whenever I see writers like, and he, if we're to take that's actually his house where Mark Patton confronts him.
Yeah.
Like, if you've done nothing since then, how do you have the money for this house?
It's probably not his house.
It's not, maybe not, but yeah, he's done nothing. He's just like kind of coasting on the fame of this gay subtext movie, barely.
Right.
Because no drag queen is inviting the writer of this movie to a horror, like, live show, right?
Right, but Mark Patton gets invited.
He goes every year.
Cabaret shows, and it's interesting, the documentary gets into what he did after the film. And it's really interesting and in some ways heartbreaking. He fell in love with this actor, Tim, who was on the show Dallas. Tim dies of AIDS. Mark has AIDS. He survived, but Mark has AIDS. And at the same time, he gets tuberculosis. And he says that he also says he got cancer, which he doesn't say anything else about the cancer, so I don't know where the cancer fits into it. But he talks about how he had AIDS and tuberculosis, and he was in bed for like a year and a half. And, you know, he lost his partner, and then he moves to Mexico and is like off the map.
Yeah, they bring up in the movie where Mark Patton just like drops off the face of the earth. And since this was like the 90s when people were trying to find him, or thousands, how do you find him?
Right.
It turns out he moved to Mexico and he opened up a store.
Right.
And
like an artist now.
He's an artist and he owns a store and he lives with his husband. And he just like, he turned this very negative thing into something positive.
Right.
Where he also brings up this really great thing. After he was found and people were like inviting him to things, he realized that the importance of showing like a gay, openly gay, like actor or, yeah, you know, someone was really important to audiences. So that's what he does. He does these like, he goes on this yearly like drag show where he does kind of like a skit comedy kind of thing.
Right.
And I think they show the movie and he shows up for when they, I think he showed up for like the 30th anniversary or screening or something, yeah, like that. So he really shows up and he says this on the documentary to make sure that we understand this.
Yeah.
And he talks a lot about the AIDS history in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I think like a big part of it was so that we can understand the context of this movie, and which is really vital to understanding what was going on with this person and Hollywood. Yeah. He brought up a point where there was a point in the AIDS crisis where he was going to be in this movie, but they were trying to cast him as a gay character and he didn't want to play a gay character.
Yeah.
He couldn't get out of it. And he was also saying that they were testing people on TV and movie lots.
Yes.
That blew my mind that they were blood testing before you could act.
Right. If you got a TV contract, they could blood test you. So it was genuinely to see if you have AIDS, HIV. So it was genuinely a witch hunt. So if you are, you know, not openly gay, and at that time you would be afraid to be because it could ruin your career, and people could, you know, there's this whole AIDS phobia thing. The fear around that time is something that he talks about. Like, he's like, you know, people now have to realize like what came before them, like what it was like then.
Yeah. He also, Robert Englund kind of makes a point too, who played Freddie, where he talks about, you know, before the 80s, people would just like kind of sleep around and it really wasn't anyone's business. And people just like had different relationships and it didn't matter. But then the 80s happened and that's when things got scary.
Right.
And he'd talk about how, like, people he knew who would have same-sex relationships, like, just dissolved them or just pretended they weren't happening.
Yeah.
And that was kind of interesting to see that from, like, a straight person's perspective.
Right.
Which is just, like, yeah, it just, everything changed. Reagan,
I love Robert Englund. I think he's so insightful. I love interviews with Robert Englund because he seems just so cool. In the documentary, he's like, yeah, when I read it, I saw the subtext. I was all about it. He talks about the scene where it's this famous scene where Freddie rips the skin off of his head and shows his brain, and he's got the glove and he's sort of menacing Mark with the glove. Mark's character's name is Jesse, and in one take, Freddie's like, Robert Englund's like, "Do you mind if in this take I like put the blade of my glove in your mouth?" And Mark Patton's like, "Sure, whatever." And they film it. It's not in the movie, but they film it, and the Mark's makeup person is like, "Oh my God, he needs makeup! Cut, cut, cut! He needs makeup!" And like ends the scene, cuts, like breaks up the scene, even though he's just the makeup artist. And the makeup artist runs up to him, and like grabs him. And is like, "Listen, don't let him put that in your mouth. It's gonna look like you're giving him a blowjob." So like, I guess the he thought he was protecting him. But it's so funny because some of the actors are like, "I had no idea," and then Robert Englund's like, "Yeah, clearly it is. Like, clearly it is."
And Robert Englund was really pushing it too, because that putting the blade in the mouth wasn't in the script. He was like, "Oh, let's really push this
right
sexuality thing."
Right.
Very interesting.
Oh, speaking of not in the script, that brings up another point of contention, which is one of the probably most infamous scenes in Nightmare on Elm Street 2 is this scene where Jesse is dancing around his room. And it's a scene where a lot of people make fun of and say this is the gayest scene because he's just sort of like dancing around. And when he confronts the writer's like, "Well, I didn't write that scene. That was your idea to dance. So don't blame me for the dancing. I said that you like did something else and then you didn't want to do that. So you danced and that dancing is what did it. Whatever. It's
the gaslighting is horrifying.
Yeah.
But it's not just dancing though. He holds out like a popper.
Yeah.
Like, at crotch level and is just pointing it at the screen and going and like gyrating his body to this tacky pop song that I've never heard of.
Right.
And it's like very obviously supposed to be phallic.
Yeah, it's an interesting... Look it up on YouTube. It's this is the scene where a lot of people say you can tell that the character or the actor playing the character is gay from the scene. Again, whether you can or not, I don't think that's what ruins the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's... Yeah, definitely not. I was kind of fascinated about... in this movie was just like sort of Mark's kind of character development as this document, the way it's cut is like, yeah. It really is like a character development because he just talks about this movie and he doesn't blame the movie, but he blames the writer for saying publicly about how he was so gay, he ruined this movie.
Right.
It affected his whole life. And you're looking at a man who's like in his 60s, right? And he's talking about something that happened.
Right.
40 years ago.
Right.
And it's like, that's the driving kind of narrative. It's just like, this drove so many of his decisions is because of this thing. And he focused all of his hatred on this writer.
Right.
And then he like confronts the writer and that's like the climax of the documentary. And afterwards he just seems lighter. And he's like, you know, right. I feel like I was focusing so much on this guy when I've had such a long life and it's over and I've made something different out of it and
right
I was it, anymore.
It's a good documentary because you can see the subject sort of have a real turn and sort of find peace, because there's this, you know, you were talking before about the scene where there's the reunion. The writer isn't at the reunion, it's just the director and the actors, and the director says to him like, you seem still really pissed off at the writer for this and maybe you need to let that go. Which I kind of feel like the director, kind of fuck him too. But he's right in the sense that he shouldn't carry that with him, even though the guy's clearly an asshole. So it ends with this apology, which is what he wanted, an apology. Whether it's sincere or not, I don't know. I think, you know, whatever.
I don't think it matters if it's really sincere. It's just that I think what Mark was really wanted was validation.
Yeah.
And that's what he got. So whether or not it's sincere was irrelevant. It's like, I finally got him to say it, you know?
Right.
To say that his actions ruined, like, this part of my life.
Right. Because you have to understand that he didn't just blame him for the failure of this movie. He outed him. Because if you say, because if people say, oh, this movie's gay, and then you say, oh, well, I didn't want it to be that way, it's because of the actor. You're saying that the actor's gay.
Yeah.
When the actor is not openly gay. And the actor, by the way, currently, while you're pointing your finger at him, is in bed because he has AIDS and tuberculosis. So yeah, it's real fucked up.
It was very fucked up. It's just a really mind-blowing story, too.
Yeah.
And I think it was just a really well-done documentary. I would strongly recommend it to people. It's also my favorite kind of genre or subgenre of documentary. It's movies about movies.
Yes.
Because you get like a whole, however we read it is going to be different from what the intention was. It's going to be different from what the actors thought of it and what they experienced while they were making it.
Right.
You get all these different sides while you're watching a documentary.
It's a perfect example of, you know, the whole idea of sort of post-structural criticism, you know, the type of, or some people often call it postmodern criticism, but that's kind of erroneous, but whatever. The idea of it being about being about the author, being about the reader, which is, and this is, we live in a world of fan communities where in some cases I think the fans maybe have too much say, like with things like Sonic. Like, to me, I feel like the power of fandom is in your reading of it and perhaps your creation of fan art or fan fiction. But, you know, people who, like, demand that they remake the last season of Game of Thrones because they didn't like it. To me, that's that's not what I think it should be.
Who do you think you are to demand a studio to pour millions of dollars into remaking a season?
I know.
You don't like it. But I agree with you. I think this movie actually showed a really positive side to fandom because there's a lot of like kind of B-roll where they go to this horror convention and they just ask people about it. And all these different people in costumes, non-costumes, different body types are like, you know, I was gay and I watched this movie and I was like, oh, that's me. I'm like that. And that was really sweet to see. It was like this movie, I love this movie because it was the first time I saw a gay person in a movie.
Right. Like, you know, there's the fandom of horror where people go to conventions and they, you know, they subscribe to Shudder and they love horror, you know, they love horror. But what, you know, you see in the film is that within that community is a smaller sub-community of LGBTQIA horror fans. And they get something out of horror. And it's not in spite of their queerness. It's because of it. Like, you know, there is, you can make the, oh God, there was a book I had years ago. I forget who wrote it, but it's called like Monsters in the Closet. And it's basically, it links the idea of queerness to monsters. And I mean, a lot of theorists have done this, that there is something, you can read something as inherently queer in horror.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And it's definitely also fans reading it too. Like they've, really reflecting and finding horror, right? And there's something really sweet about it. And that movie, the documentary, made me want to go to a horror convention.
Yeah, I'd like to go to a horror convention.
It just sounds fun, honestly.
Yeah.
And I really want to find where that drag show is, where they do like a Halloween drag show. Yeah. Like that sounds great.
Yeah. It seems like so much fun.
Yeah.
So let me. When you watched A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, what were your thoughts on it? Was that the first time you saw it?
Yeah. So
did you watch the documentary before or after?
I watched the movie before the documentary.
Okay.
So it was before it came out. I just wanted to watch it because of its history. Mm. It's like this is the gay Freddy Krueger movie.
Yeah.
So I watched it relatively recently, like a year or two ago. It was on Shudder. I can't say if it's on Shudder anymore because, you know, it's a streaming service. They move stuff around.
Yeah.
I don't know. But really all I got out of it was just like, now I know what this is. I wouldn't say it's interesting enough to like go out and see it other than for like understanding, maybe if you want to, the context to a documentary, or if you just want to know what what's it famous about. Like, it's not a good movie.
Right.
The Freddy makeup changed.
Yeah.
I don't think it's better. It kind of ends in a weird way, like with a school bus.
Right.
I don't think the acting is that great. I mean, it's just like a horror conventional sequel where it has some elements to the original, but it's not enough to make it good.
Right.
It's in that weird middle where it's too different, but also not different enough to be interesting.
Have you seen, what other of the Nightmare on Elm Street films have you seen?
I know I've watched a couple like years ago when Blockbuster still existed, but I don't remember them. I just remember what I saw recently, which was in the last couple of years, I watched the original Nightmare on Elm Street, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, and I watched Dream Warriors. I didn't like Dream Warriors.
Okay.
I'll be honest. I think the first one's the best Freddy movie.
It's interesting talking about the idea of different context reading films in a different way. I saw A Nightmare on Elm Street a showing, a theatrical showing. I think it was at Brooklyn Academy of Music.
Wait, I was with you.
You were?
Yeah, okay. Didn't we go with your brother?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you remember people laughing at its campiness?
Yes.
And I couldn't be mad at it because it really was campy. And it's so interesting because you think when this movie came out, people weren't laughing at it. But people are happily laughing at it now, and it's like, it's just simple things like that that show, like, how reading is the most important thing, because the context in which it was made is not the context in which it's currently read.
Yeah. And you can't, like, you can't go back either. It's like, this is it. This was made in this time. It's not going to change. Like, you can't go back in time and be scared at these movies. Like, there's no way.
Right.
We've seen quite scarier stuff.
Yeah. There's an interesting scene in the documentary where they show a montage of movies, some of them kids' movies, some of them major motion pictures that use the F word or make homophobic jokes. And it's the montage is driving home the point that it was so normal and casual to just make homophobic jokes in movies, to use the F word in movies. And it just, it kind of blows your mind.
You know, honestly, it's not even that long ago.
No,
you can go
not.
Back to the, you could go back to the thousands and see, like,
right.
Really,
it's like 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Patton says that. It's like 5 minutes ago.
We're so quick to forget, you know?
Yeah.
And now, which we talked about, you know, another episode, which is just now that things are streaming, we can see them again in a different context.
Yeah.
But also the streaming service can, if they want, censor certain things.
Right.
Right. So we're getting different readings and we're getting different just experiences. It's just so odd.
Yeah.
Is there a movie from the 80s that scared you, but is still scary? Like you would say?
You know what? I recently rewatched all the Friday the 13th, and I think that they still work. I think that they still, you know, there's a lot of jump scares, and I think that just on a visceral level works. You know, when I was younger, I used to think the Nightmare on Elm Street were the better movies and the Jason movies were trashy. But looking back now, I actually think the Jason movies are better.
When you say better, what do you mean?
Scarier.
Okay.
And hold together better. I mean, both series constantly go through writers and directors and actors and just, it's just, even though like they're making them year after year, somehow they don't keep the same people.
Yeah.
But I think, I don't know, I think, you know, I've only recently watched, with you, I watched the first Nightmare on Elm Street, and I was not scared in that. But I when I watched the Friday the 13th movies, I was scared.
What's the scariest Friday the 13th movie?
Oh, what's the scariest? Maybe it's got to be 2 or 3. The best is the 6th one.
Really?
Yeah. Because it's just funny and well-directed and well-written. It's just the best one. On Shudder, they have like an 8-hour documentary about all of the fucking Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah, I don't think I'm ever going to be like ready for that. 8 hours.
Have you watched those movies?
I don't remember the Friday the 13th movies. I may have watched them like renting from Blockbuster, but that was so long ago, I can't even fathom. Where are they streaming now? Are they streaming?
I believe, you know what? I don't think so. Oh, wait, no, maybe they're on, they might be on Amazon.
Yeah.
I spent, like, a little bit of money and bought, like, the box set DVD.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't that much. yeah, you know, the Chuckies, I always liked them, but I never thought they were really scary. I always thought Chucky was just funny and entertaining.
I watched Child's Play also sort of recently. And yeah, it's not scary because he's three people. There's like a weird voodoo thing.
There's a witch doctor. People forget that about that movie.
I never knew that was a thing. And you know, that was like a thing in like horror for a while too, where there's just this like ambiguous voodoo curse
or
something. And that just makes the evil happen. And like, we don't really do that anymore.
Right. No. Thank God.
Thank God.
You and me both watched the movie Babadook together, and a lot of people read a queer subtext in that film.
How?
I don't know, but it's I mean, it's a thing. I'm not making that up.
No, yeah. I've heard of that. And they even, I think they released a Babadook, like, poster or DVD or something, like, in him in Rainbow or something weird like that.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny, but it's been a few years, but I don't remember anything about that movie that could be, like, a queer subtext. I would have to watch it again.
I don't remember where they're getting it. See, it's always weird with horror, right? Because horror is inherently horrible. You're showing something, you're showing a situation that you would not want someone to be in. To represent queerness in it, you run the risk of making queerness look like a terrible thing.
Yeah.
I remember years ago, there was an interesting dialogue. I forget what it was. This was in grad school, and I read a lot of, like, deep theory. And this was probably in some academic journal, but it was two critics arguing about the film Black Swan with Natalie Portman. They both agreed that it was queer, but one was saying that it's very liberating and positive, and the other was saying, no, it's horrific. It's making queerness look like it's like the end of the world. And in that argument, I think you see that argument a lot of things in the Freddy movie and Babadook. You know, it's hard to get at that, you know what I mean? Because horror, you don't want to, you know, you identify with protagonists in any narrative, but to identify with a protagonist in a horror story is to identify with someone who's doomed in some way.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have something very current for it to not be horrible. Like, right now I'm taking a look at my Shudder, because Shudder has, like, different folders, and one of their folders is queer horror. It's because I'm looking at, like, what I've seen before, right? And there's a short film called The Quiet Room, which is queer horror because the protagonist is queer, and he's, like, in this mental institution, and he's being hunted by something.
Okay.
And he does a lot of flashbacks to his old boyfriend, and in that case, like, the movie isn't about his queerness being horrible. It's that something horrible is happening to a queer person. That's very different.
So would you call that a queer text, or would you just say that's a text where the protagonist happens to be homosexual?
See, I would say it would just it would have to be about, it would just be the protagonist is queer. Huh. But the thing with that is that then we get into this weird kind of identity thing, because it's not just about being queer, but being queer is a big part of this character. Because it's a short film. It's only like 12 minutes long or 20 minutes or something. So, but him and his relationship is a big part of the movie. So, that's the thing. I don't know if I could say if that's a queer text or not.
Uh-huh.
And just like a few other things that I'm looking over here, some of them I haven't watched. Some of them are just like queer texts, like Hellraiser.
Interesting. Hellraiser, yeah. I guess it is, because it's very S&M-y, and it's very like, Hellraiser's interesting. I've also read the short story that it's based on, and it's about, instead of, like, the horror happening to somebody, the person goes looking for it. Like, this guy is, like, he wants to fuck everything and drink everything and smoke everything. And he seeks out this sort of cube, which is where you open up, it's like a puzzle, and you open it up and the Hellraiser comes out.
Yeah.
And they're, like, demons, but in the book they're also called angels. And he's, like, looking for this ultimate experience. And he sort of gets it. So he's like looking for it. It's really, wow, okay. It's also very leathery.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense to me.
It's an interesting, like, when you look at these streaming services, and I mean, you could also say it like back then with like a video store, it's just like how things are categorized is fascinating.
Yeah.
You know? Like, there, and so it's just like, it's queer horror, but the reason why this folder was created is because Shudder, or the people who are creating the Shudder catalog, they know that there are queer audience that wants to watch these films.
Right.
Right? So that's why this is here. And that's what's really interesting about it, is like deciding what is a queer movie, or like what is seen as queer, or what queer people like gravitate to.
Right, right, right.
You know?
I'm looking through a list online, and I'm seeing like The Babadook, Roar, which I haven't seen, Tragedy Girls.
We've seen that together.
Yeah, for sure.
Even though the characters aren't really seen as queer, the only person that they care about are each other, and they commit atrocities with love, because it's really like a love story, but it's not sexual.
They're also closeted as sociopaths. Neither of them have emotions, and they both know what it's like to pretend to have emotions.
Yeah.
But that gets into that thing we were just talking about, which is, if that's a metaphor for queerness, that makes queerness sound awful. You know what I mean? It makes it sound like, oh, that's a bad thing. So it's such a slippery slope with that.
That's true.
Jennifer's Body, that's a good film. I remember liking that film.
I haven't seen Jennifer's Body. I just like read a lot about it, because it's a movie that's even in the trailer they were really pushing the monster in the movie was bisexual.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, this is interesting. Vulture did a whole list of queer horror movies,
and they
have The Bride of Frankenstein on it.
Oh.
Well, you've got that character, Dr. What's his name? Dr. Pretorius, who's clearly very queer-coded. And the director, James Whale, was gay. And there's that scene where Dr. Pretorius, like, he has that little, like, date with the monster.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and there's something queer in the truest sense about, like, those Frankenstein movies, you kind of don't know when they take place. Like, and where they take place, it's like, is this the past? Is this the present? It kind of doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. So there's something I was looking up. Have you heard of Horror Noir?
I've heard of it. It's a documentary, right?
It's a documentary about black horror.
Uh-huh.
It's really good. It's on Shudder. It's a Shudder original. It's really great. But they're also, I don't know when it's coming out, but it, according to the Shudder blog, from a story from last year, they're making a queer horror documentary. So all about queer movies and making of queer horror, which should be really fascinating to take a look at.
That is fascinating. But I tell you what else is fascinating, that you hang out on a Shudder blog.
I'm a huge fan. I'm sorry. It's...
Well, you know what they call you, right? Shudder Bugs. That's with a T.
Yeah, very, very different.
All right.
But, yes.
All right, thank you, Nadia. I think this has been a good episode. This has been PCMC. I'm Mike Bongiorno. I'm joined by Nadia Cater. If you haven't seen the movie Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street, or the film A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, or any of the movies we've spoken about, go and check them out. We end every episode by saying...
Go bye-bye.